Hi, this is Bev.
And this is Diz.
And this is...
Trigger Warning.
Welcome to our first episode. Each week we're going to tell you stories full of Marvel's mysteries and misdeeds, and our first story is a big one. We've got mystery and misdeeds in this one, so sit back, grab a snack, and get ready for the story of the Hodges family murder. Okay, so we're going to start with our trigger warnings. This does contain mentions of child molestation and child death. I don't go into a whole lot of details, but if it's something that is not something you can handle, then you may want to skip this first episode. So we are starting out on Monday, August 29th, 1994. This is starting around 4:30 that morning in a little town in Virginia called Vinton. We start out with a lady driving on her way to work. She works at a fast food restaurant. Her name is Dorothy McGee. And she notices on her way to work a pinkish-red truck with a dark tailgate entering the roadway near the address at 232 East Virginia Avenue in Vinton. She noticed the truck's being driven by a white male. He's by himself. She said that he followed her briefly and then, quote-unquote, shot past her, exceeding the speed limit. Mm-hmm. A few minutes later, Robert Arnie was traveling on Virginia Avenue and noticed a large cloud of smoke coming across the highway, very thick, is what he referred to it as. Around the same time, another man driving by, Mark Stevens, noticed the smoke as well and stopped. So Arnie and Stevens rushed to this house and banged on the front and back doors, but got no response. On the side door and the back door was a note that said, "Had an emergency, back late Sunday, early Monday, Teresa." The men broke open a window, but the heat burned their eyes, so they couldn't really do anything. Stevens ran back to the road trying to flag down a car, and Arnie actually used a radio in his car to call for help. Stevens said that several cars passed by, but eventually a police officer, one source says he was patrolling, another says he was off duty. But either way, he noticed either the flashing hazard lights of one of their cars, or he was flagged down by Stevens, depending on which source you see it in. So he stopped to check out what was going on. Firefighters and police arrived at the scene, but they quickly found out this was more than just a house fire. Inside the house, there are four people, all deceased.
Oh my gosh.
On the couch downstairs, with burns over nearly 90% of her body, is Teresa Hodges. She's 37. Upstairs, responders discovered her husband, William Blaine Hodges, age 41, in the master bedroom. In another bedroom, they found the bodies of the two children, Winter Hodges, who was 11, and Anna, age 3. They were actually laying in the same bed together. Anna was said to be covered in soot and had mild burns. Winter had no obvious injuries from the fire itself. It was pretty obvious from the beginning that Teresa, Winter, and Anna had been murdered. Teresa had been strangled, and an accelerant, either gasoline or diesel fuel, depending on the source again, had been poured on her, and she was set on fire. Winter and Anna had both been shot at point-blank range.
Oh my gosh.
Their father, Blaine, had been shot in the head. The gun with the missing barrel was laying next to him in the master bedroom. Police basically theorized immediately that Blaine had killed his wife and kids, set the house on fire, and then killed himself.
Right. Murder-suicide is what right. It sounds like.
Family annihilator. Exactly. Yeah. So it turns out that Blaine actually was in some legal trouble. Which kind of furthered the idea that maybe he had killed himself and his family. He'd lost his job at the U.S. Postal Service the year before, had been accused of stealing money from his cash drawer. One source I saw, but I didn't see more than one to confirm it, was around $4,500.
Oh, wow.
He claimed to be innocent, but he had been convicted, and he was sentenced to serve 6 months in prison and pay restitution. And I did find one source that said the restitution was around $9,500, which he didn't have, the family didn't have. And his prison sentence was actually due to start in September. And keep in mind, this was August 29th when the fire happened.
Yeah.
So they had begun, when he lost his job, he and Teresa had begun selling Amway products, which I don't even know if Amway still exists now.
I don't know.
Since this was 94, but I don't know if they still exist. But according to Teresa's father, they were actually beginning to see a return on their investment. And 2 weeks earlier, Teresa had stopped by with the girls after church to visit her father. His name's Dave Fulcher. And Mr. Fulcher recalled that Teresa was smiling and happy and explaining that their Amway business was becoming successful. He also recalled that the girls ran to him and gave him big hugs and kisses on the cheek, and Winter wouldn't let them leave until she showed off her new school belongings. The morning of the murders, August 29th, was supposed to be the first day of school that year for Winter Hodges.
Oh, wow.
Winter didn't get to start her school year that year, 11 years old, and I remember how exciting it was to show off new clothes, new outfit, new Absolutely. Backpack. So...
All the new gear.
Really sad that, but at least her grandfather had that last memory of her and little Anna, who was only 3. So.
And they were so happy. That's really nice for him to have that memory.
It is. And his daughter was happy. Teresa was really happy because she said the business was doing well. So anyway, so the police began their investigation, started collecting evidence, questioning family and friends, trying to figure out a timeline of the family's movements over the past few days.
Uh-huh.
And when they mentioned that the sign that had been on the side door and the back door about the emergency, none of their friends or family knew anything about any kind of emergency. Other than that, there were also conflicting stories about when the family was last seen, when somebody last talked to them. So several people told them that if they wanted to know about the family's schedule and movements, they should talk to Earl Bramblett. And so this is what we know about Earl. Earl Conrad Bramblett was born March 20th, 1942 in Sweetwater, Texas. He moved around a little bit, but he ended up in Virginia and was a sign maker and painter and worked for his father's business at first. Eventually, he took on more and more of the business as his father aged and ailed and that sort of thing. He had been married. He had 2 sons, Mike and Doug. He had been a coach at Jefferson High School in Roanoke, Virginia.
Oh, wow.
This is actually where he met Blaine Hodges, who was a track and field student back in the 70s. So Blaine would have been a teenager and Earl would have been in his 30s probably around this time.
Yeah.
And they stayed friends after Blaine graduated. And he spent a lot of time with the family and the girls referred to him as Uncle Earl. Police tracked him down, asked him to come to the Vinton Police Department for an interview. And Earl did that. And was told that there had been a fire and that Blaine, Teresa, and the 2 little girls had all passed away. They said Earl seemed upset, but they didn't see tears. But he did seem like he was crying, just without tears. He then slammed his fist on a piece of furniture, either the table or filing cabinet. I saw a couple different things. And blurted out, "That son of a bitch. He had a beautiful family. He did them and then he did himself."
What?
Yeah. So he paused when he saw that they were confused, and he's like, "They were murdered, weren't they?"
What? Yeah. Red flag.
Yeah, red flag. Red flag. Because at this point, nobody knew about the murders. They only knew that the family had died in a fire. That's all that had been released to the press, was that there was a fire and that the family had died.
Wow.
So he later asked them in the same interview, "Are you going to arrest me for this?" They didn't.
What?
Yeah. They didn't, but he obviously became the prime suspect at that point.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah. So the original theory that Blaine had actually killed his family and then killed himself was kind of discarded quickly because of a couple things. First of all, the coroner reported that Blaine Hodges had been killed 12 to 24 hours prior to the rest of the family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So obviously... a dead man can't kill people. And the gun that was found next to him was missing the barrel. And usually people remove the barrel to prevent ballistics from matching the bullets to the gun. But if Blaine shot his family, set the house on fire, and then killed himself with the gun laying next to him, there's no reason to try to cover up that that gun was the murder weapon.
Yeah.
So it turned out, as the police started looking into things, that... Earl Bramblett had a white truck with a black tailgate, which resembled the one that Dorothy McGee had spotted at 4:30 that morning on her way to work.
But wasn't that one referred to as a pinkish red?
It was. But they think that the streetlights that were burning at the time, at that time of the morning, would have made it look pinkish red.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. But this actually came up as a contention kind of in court later.
Uh-huh.
Another witness said that they'd seen Earl drive by a couple times without stopping after the firefighters and everybody got there. So there were questions of, you know, if he's such a good friend and these people mean so much to him, why would he not stop if there was emergency personnel at the house?
Right. And obviously at their house.
Yeah, they were all over the place at that point. So the police actually checked with Earl's place of employment, which I thought that he was the owner of, but apparently wherever he was working, he clocked in and out because he clocked in that morning at 5:08 a.m. His work was about 20 minutes from the Hodges.
Uh-huh.
So he got there at 5:08 and then he blacked out the entry. So I guess he realized that he was proving that he was less than 20 minutes from the crime scene at, like, right at the time that it would have been if he'd left there and gone to work. And he was, yeah, so either out of habit or because he just wanted to get paid or whatever, he clocked in. So then he blacked out the time card, but the time clock was one of the old-fashioned ones where you put the time card in a slot and the machine basically stamps it with the time.
Yeah.
So
old school. Wow. Yeah.
So even if it was blacked out, the indentions on the paper where the stamp actually happened would have still been able to be found. And forensics did uncover, obviously, that he had clocked in that morning. So the police also searched Earl's motel room where he was staying, his truck, his storage unit, and they found bullet casings that matched the ones at the crime scene. They also found bullets that were made of the same chemical composition as the ones that had killed the Hodges.
Oh my gosh.
They did some testing on the gun too. Although the barrel of the gun was missing, the gun's firing pin also leaves marks on the shell casings.
Uh-huh.
And when they compared these, the marks matched. So, not as good, I think, as like the rifling on a bullet, like the around the outside of the bullet itself.
Right.
But each gun still has its own firing pin and would leave specific marks like on the shell case. Yeah, exactly. At his place of employment, the police also found a drawing of stick figures with arrows pointing at the locations of the bullet wounds on the girls and on Blaine Hodges.
Creepy.
Yeah. Like, what kind of dumbass goes to work then and draws the crime that he just created?
You know what? Thank goodness. Or
maybe
for
he
that.
Did it before. Maybe he did it before because he was planning it out. I'm not sure. They also found at his workplace a pair of his pants and a sink full of water soaking. They tested the pants, and lo and behold, they found the accelerant that matched the one that had been poured on Teresa and set the house on fire.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. This is kind of a sad thing. The police found a pubic hair in the bed where Winter and Anna were, and the pubic hair was DNA tested and found to match Earl Bramblett as well.
Ugh.
Forensic testing, of course, is not like it is in the movies and TV. It takes time. And while all of this is happening, the police were tracking him even when he left Roanoke and Vinton in Virginia. This is where it gets really messed up, but really interesting as well. About a year prior to the killings, Earl had mailed two boxes to his sister who lived in Indiana.
Okay.
And he had lived a fairly transient life. After his marriage broke up, he moved around a little bit. He lived in his truck. He lived in campsites. He lived in hotel rooms. He stayed with friends. Mm-hmm. He stayed with the Hodges some. So when she got these couple boxes, she thought it wasn't any big deal. It was just something for safekeeping. So she stuck it in the back of a closet and forgot about it.
Right. As one would do.
Right. Didn't open it. I guess she figured none of her business. Whatever. It's just some of Earl's junk. Whatever. So on September 2nd, 1994, so only like three or four days after the killings, Earl drove to Indiana and got there around 7:30 p.m. and he told her that he felt like the police were going to arrest him. So this sister overheard him on the phone with another of their siblings saying that a lawyer in Roanoke had told him to leave town since he hadn't been charged with anything. Around 2:30 that same morning, so he was there less than 12 hours.
Uh-huh.
He left. But he never mentioned the boxes that he sent her. He never asked for them back. He never said, don't open them. He never said anything about the boxes.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the sister's daughter reminded her that the boxes were there. And since Earl had been acting kind of sus, obviously, she decided to take them to the sheriff in town. And she signed a waiver to let them open and search the boxes. And this is where it gets really effed up, because inside were 62 audio tapes.
Oh my gosh.
And pictures of the Hodges children.
Ugh.
One source I found said that the box, one of the boxes contained a little girl's sock that possibly belonged to Winter.
Oh, that's so gross.
Yeah, but I couldn't find anything else that said this.
Uh-huh.
And the actual court document I was reading up on this doesn't mention it either. So I'm not for sure that there was one in there, but there were definitely the audio tapes and pictures of the kids.
Wow.
The audio tapes were like a treasure trove of Earl's ramblings. He apparently really liked the sound of his own voice because he spoke of everything. His everyday interactions with the Hodges. He talked about being angry at Blaine and Teresa. He suspected that Blaine was trying to set a trap for him that he could then use to get out of his trouble with the embezzlement charges.
Oh, wow.
So Earl decided in his twisted brain that Blaine had plotted to entice Earl sexually using his 11-year-old daughter, Winter.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Insane. 11-year-olds don't even know what enticement is. But that's and Earl said that Winter was attempting to seduce him at her father's instruction and that she, quote, knew what she was doing.
Shut your mouth. Absolutely not.
This dude was obviously messed up.
Obviously.
So he ranted in these tapes about Blaine trying to trick him so he'd have leverage to go to the police and get Earl in trouble. And that this would give Blaine the leverage he needed to get out of his own legal problems.
Oh my gosh.
And side note, Earl had actually been arrested in 1984, so 10 years prior to this, for molesting a 10-year-old girl, but was not convicted.
Ooh.
So, yeah. And I doubt seriously that Blaine knew this, although Blaine would have known him at the time. I'm assuming Blaine didn't know this because he had two little girls.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, Anna wasn't born yet, but Winter would have been an infant 10 years previous, so, you know. Anyway, so Earl moved on. He ended up living in Spartanburg, South Carolina, and he was arrested in Spartanburg, South Carolina on July 30th, 1996. The people there were absolutely shocked. He started a new life. He was a good neighbor, quote-unquote. According to those in his community, people who knew him there were just flabbergasted. They knew him as a friendly man who walked his three-legged dog, Lucky, every day.
Aww.
And P.S., Lucky is really cute, but it's also a cliche to name a three-legged dog Lucky. I'm sorry. He could have come up with something more clever than that, but apparently he didn't have the brain power. So, Nikki Speedy Mart, the co-owner there, said that Earl would have done anything for you. And he knew him as the man that stopped by every day to get a bag of beef jerky for Lucky and a 12-pack of Milwaukee's Best for himself. And he said, quote, he was a great fella, one of the nicest people we ever met. People said he was quiet, but I never noticed that shyness. We talked every day. Earl had gotten a job at Sky Vision Signs and Designs, owned by Sherman Swofford, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Earl was actually at work when he got arrested. The police called Swofford and said they were coming in. And the owner of Nikki Speedy Mart that I mentioned before said, it's like he died. I mean, police talk like it's open and shut. He just doesn't seem like the type, but I guess they never do. Bramblett was extradited back to Virginia. He was indicted on one count of capital murder, 3 counts of first degree murder, 3 counts of use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, and arson. He pled not guilty. The trial took place in October and November of 1997, over the course of about 14 days. His defense attorney requested that the case be tried in a different jurisdiction, stating that media coverage in Roanoke County was extensive and could make it difficult to find an impartial jury. The Roanoke County Circuit Court Judge Roy Willett said, quote, the lawyers can handle it more efficiently here. If we can't pick a fair jury here, then we'll move it someplace where we can. So he basically said, nah, we're good.
Uh-huh.
Earl's defense team also questioned the validity of Dorothy McGee's eyewitness testimony, like we talked about before. She had said that she saw a pinkish red truck. and he had a white truck. So, but the prosecutors, the police had expected this, and they had actually made a video of a truck driving down the road at the same time in the morning, and in the lights, it really, the white truck really did look pinkish red.
Wow.
Because of the type of lights they were, they burned and they threw off that color. That, yeah. So it made, yeah, which makes sense. I mean, in the middle, in dawn, you know, even if the, I mean, I guess the sun hadn't come up yet, but if it was close to the dawn, when the sun starts to come up, it's pink.
Yeah, it's just
the morning
be a
has
pink.
That hue, you know, but apparently it was the lights anyway. So that was kind of covered.
Right.
Two women testified in his trial that in the 1970s, Bramblett had given them alcohol and molested them when they were 11 and 14 years old. Mm. And judging by his previous arrest for the 10-year-old, that sounds valid.
Sounds like his MO.
Of course, the statute of limitations was up by that point, so there was nothing they could do legally about that, but it showed his pattern of behavior.
Right.
A man named Tracy Turner testified that while he was incarcerated with Bramblett in the Roanoke County Jail, Earl had told him that he was, quote, addicted to little girls.
Oh, and gross.
Yeah. Yeah, the guy, apparently Tracy Turner had some drug problems and stuff, and had, you know, mentioned addictions and stuff, and Earl was like, well, I'm addicted to little girls. So, according to him, Earl had told him that the night of Sunday, August 28th, he'd been caught with that girl, the young girl, quote, caught with that girl, the young girl. He testified that Bramblett had been caught by Teresa with Winter, and that Teresa had sent Winter upstairs, and then Bramblett then, quote, choked the life out of her. So, the course of the trial, the last few days, the Hodges family's lives were laid out, you know, their movements and everything, as they had come to investigate and figure out.
Uh-huh.
So, on Friday, August 26, 1994, Blaine and Teresa Hodges had attended an Amway conference in Charlottesville, Virginia. Which was, I guess that's what, a couple hours from Vinton.
Yeah.
Blaine had picked up the kids from a relative's house on Saturday, August 27th. Around 5 p.m. that day, a friend spoke with Blaine by phone. Later on Saturday, a friend called the residence, but no one answered, and the answering machine didn't pick up. It's believed that Earl had already cut the phone lines at this point. So, obviously, he was planning something. On Sunday, August 28th, a neighbor had seen Bramblett with Teresa and the kids. Earl, Teresa, Winter, and Anna were seen by a forest ranger at a nearby national forest on Sunday afternoon. They went fishing, and the ranger remembered seeing them specifically because of Earl's white truck with a black tailgate.
Ah.
Yeah, so number one lesson, if you're going to do a crime, have a little more nondescript vehicle, because that right. one's pretty freaking obvious. It's possible that before they left to go fishing, Blaine had decided not to go, and Earl took the opportunity to go back in the house and kill him, since it was determined that he died, you know, 12 to 24 hours prior to everybody else.
Right.
So he was possibly dead when they went to go fishing. Oh, he'd already been killed.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. I know. It's like, it's chilling, because he would have gone fishing with him, then maybe things would have been a little different, but maybe he decided not to go, and anyway, so Earl took that opportunity, possibly, they can't confirm that, but that he went back in and killed him, and so he was possibly laying there dead while the kids and Teresa were fishing with Uncle Earl. So around 4:30 that afternoon, Teresa left a message with a friend about carpool plans for Monday morning, since it was the first day of school. Her friend called her back a little bit later, but the number that Teresa gave her was a payphone at a gas station down the street. So Teresa probably thought that the phones just weren't working and didn't realize the phone lines had been cut.
Yeah.
So she called the friend. I guess she tried to call her from the house and couldn't, and went down to the gas station, called the friend.
Uh-huh.
And said, call me back here at whatever time. The friend called back. They made the plans. Two other friends stopped by also on Sunday evening. Again, this is August 28th. One stopped by at 7:15 p.m. and one around 8:45 p.m. Both of them found those notes on the door about the emergencies.
Mm-hmm.
Both family cars were in the driveway. and there were no lights on except the one in the basement. The visitor that came at 8:45 called the house, but didn't get an answer, and the answering machine did not pick up, because it wouldn't have if the phone lines were cut.
Right, okay.
So, overall, throughout the trial, 98 witnesses testified in wow. some capacity. Yeah. The jury deliberated for only 1 hour before they found him guilty on all counts.
What?
One hour? Yeah. The length of time that it would probably take me to record this episode is how long the jury was like, yeah, he's guilty.
Yeah.
And then they probably like subs or something, and there was no other reason to talk about anything else. Anyway, so on December 16th, 1997, he was given the death sentence. As expected, the case was appealed. I think it's an automatic appeal when there's a death sentence implemented.
So, right.
They based their appeal on several different things. Bramblett and his defense team said that the court made an error in denying their motion to dismiss the case on the grounds that the death penalty is unconstitutional. So this is in 94. Obviously, the death penalty thing was a big deal at the time, and the argument over whether or not it was right or wrong.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to get into that, but basically, the court upheld the original decision to deny the motion because they, quote, have rejected it in other cases and will not revisit it here.
Oh, wow.
So they basically were just like, no, we've been there, we've done that, we're not talking about that crap anymore. Yeah, we're not going through this shit right now. Virginia's going to kill people. So the appeal also cited prosecutorial misconduct, stating that the prosecutor had withheld evidence in violation of court orders and had asked questions during the trial which he knew were objectionable. And the appellate court ruling stated, quote, we do not entertain such issues that are raised for the first time on appeal. Basically, since the defense team didn't bring it up in the original trial, too bad, so sad.
Well, yeah, if they thought that the lawyer was asking questions that were
objectionable, then they should have objected.
Then they should have objected.
That's the way TV, I know, because TV tells me.
Yeah.
TV tells me that you're supposed to and object
Hollywood,
right then. You're
like,
supposed to object everything that they say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's idiotic.
Yeah, it's like if he's asking questions that they shouldn't have been asking, then yeah, they should have objected at the time. And that's basically what the court said.
Yeah.
It's too bad. It's too late now, you know? So the appeal also questioned the decision to hold his trial in Roanoke. Again, the appellate court upheld the decision, saying that it's assumed that a fair trial can be held in the jurisdiction where the crime was committed. And it said that the defense team did not prove that the citizens of the jurisdiction harbored any specific prejudice toward him
uh-huh.
that would prevent a fair trial. Because it's supposed to be a jury of your peers, I guess, so it should be in the jurisdiction where the crime happened, because the crime is against not only the victims, but the community at large, I think is how they look at it. So they really try to hold the any trial where it happened.
Yeah.
I think they don't change the venue unless there really is like an obvious, like, everybody in town already believes that he's the killer, and everybody's saying that, oh no, he definitely did it. But they said during jury selection, 7 out of 68 potential jurors were dismissed because of fixed opinions. Only 7.
Wow.
Yeah, so basically the appellate court were like, selecting the jury was easy. Obviously there were only 7 people that straight up said they had an opinion about whether or not you did it. So,
there's
not
no
valid.
Reason, yeah.
Yeah, so they tossed that one too. The appeal also said that the court erred by finding that Bramblett was competent to stand trial.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
So they're saying that he was mentally unsound or not competent mentally to stand trial. Three different psychologists had interviewed him. And the first one said that he wasn't sure about his competency and he needed to be re-interviewed. But the other two said, yes, he was competent. That he had some delusions and stuff like that, but competency is not like a mental illness or stuff like that. It's basically, does this person have the ability to assist in his own defense?
Right. Yeah.
Does he understand what's going on? You know, the degree of importance or what a big deal it is.
Uh-huh.
And is he able to help his lawyers in defending himself?
Right.
So According to the three psychologists, they came to the conclusion, yes, he was competent. So that portion of the appeal was dismissed as well.
He's just batting a thousand, isn't he?
Yeah, he's like, but what about this? Can we please? It's like they're just throwing everything out there. And that's probably what they do, really, is anything they can come up with to see if something sticks.
When there's so much against him that is...
Exactly, yeah. It's like, we really don't have a leg to stand on, so we're going to try everything we possibly
can. Anything at all.
Including stuff that they had brought up at the beginning, like the change of venue and stuff like that. Yeah. It's like, this was already ruled on, and so they just upheld all the rulings, basically. So, in the original trial, Bramblett's attorney had also filed a motion to throw out the evidence of the audio tapes that were supplied by Earl Bramblett's sister. They said that she had no right to release the evidence to authorities, so it was an illegal search and seizure.
What?
Yeah.
This is just ridiculous.
The trial judge had said no, that they didn't need a warrant because she signed off on it, and that the boxes were addressed to her and were in her sole possession, and that Bramblett had never imposed any restrictions on them and had therefore no remaining expectation of privacy regarding the boxes and the items in them.
Love that legalese.
Yeah, basically, yeah, it's like, you sent them to her, you never told her not to show them to anybody, never told her not to open them, never told her what to do with them. He visited her a few days after the killing, never said anything then. So, she had every right. They were in her possession. They were hers. They belonged to her.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, she had every right to turn them over to the authorities, is what they're basically saying. Yeah. And she signed a waiver saying it was okay to search them. So there were a few other things that were in the little thingamabobber. One was about the inmate that had testified and his criminal history, but that they hadn't been given enough time to know about his past. But they had found out days before trial, so the judges were like, psh, you knew, you had time, you're fine. There were a couple other little things that were just really too boring to mention, so I'm not going to go into them. basically, they said everything stood. And then on April 9th, 2003, Earl Conrad Bramblett, by then age 61, was executed by the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Earl had bad that I want to hear the applause right now?
I know. I was like, should I hit the applause button? I don't know. So, Earl had a choice between the electric chair and lethal injection. Because at that time, like I said, there were debates about whether the death penalty was constitutional or humane or whatever. So, in several states, I think at the time that still had the death penalty, they had a choice as to whether they wanted to do the lethal injection or the electric chair, was what Virginia said. I don't know if other ones had other options, but that was what Earl had the choice between.
Okay.
So, he chose the electric chair, which, again, that shows his brain power to me, because that just seems so much worse than a lethal injection.
Oh my gosh.
But he said he did it as a form of protest. And I always like to find out what the killer's final words were. So, his final words were, quote, "I didn't murder the Hodges family. I've never murdered anybody. I'm going to my death with a clear conscience. I'm going to my death having had a great life because of my two great sons, Mike and Doug," unquote.
Wow.
So, that sounds like the story's over, but it's not.
There's more?
There's more. So, we have this, you know, the marvels and the mysteries and the misdeeds, and this was the misdeeds. Now we're actually going to go into the mystery, because this was actually figured out pretty quickly. It just took time for all the evidence to be processed. The mystery part of this comes up because Bramblett never actually officially admitted to killing the Hodges family.
Uh-huh.
But right up to the day he died, there were two other families in Virginia that were hoping that his conscience would get to him and he'd admit to another crime that he is suspected of.
Oh.
So, on February 7th, 1977, Angela Rader and her friend Tammy Akers were dropped off in front of their school, William Ruffner Junior High in Roanoke, Virginia. Both of the girls were 14. They decided to skip school that day. They were last seen hitchhiking in Roanoke City.
Do not hitchhike. Yeah. Do not do it.
I mean, it was a big thing back in the
70s. I know it was a different time, but it's so scary.
I know. It's terrifying to me. And I don't really know how anybody back then even thought that it was okay. Because strangers. Like, it just, it, yeah. But anyway, they decided to hitchhike. I'm not saying it's their fault, but anyway.
Right.
They'd run away together before. So their disappearances, when they were reported to the police, were not taken seriously. Oh, they're like, they're runaways. They'll be back in a few days when they, you know, they don't have any money. They're hungry, whatever.
This is what they do.
Yeah, exactly. The girls were actually friends with Earl Bramblett. They worked for him sometimes in the sign shop. And they spent time with him and his wife in their home.
So he definitely liked being around young girls.
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah. My very next line. It was noticed by the girls' parents that Earl didn't seem to have any adult friends at the time, only children.
Creepy.
Yes. So Tammy Aker's older sister said that Earl Bramblett actually molested her when she was younger, and she believed he was doing the same thing to Tammy.
Oh my gosh.
3 years after their disappearances, while at a party, Bramblett drunkenly stated he wished he, quote, hadn't hurt Tammy.
Hadn't hurt Tammy.
Tammy, yeah. He was drunk. Wish he hadn't hurt Tammy. So he denied any connection to their disappearances then and from then on. And he said that comment when he was drunk that night was taken out of context. So right. I don't know. Do you mean you wish you hadn't molested her? Or that you hadn't killed her?
Like, right.
Either way, you hurt her somehow, so you're an asshole.
I mean, alcohol can sometimes be a truth serum.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And I think that's probably what it was, is he let down his guard and was thinking about it. Because that was 1980. That was only 3 years later.
Yeah.
So I'm sure it was still fresh in his mind, and he hadn't killed an entire family yet. So, you know, it was a little harder on him, I guess. So 8 months after Bramblett was sentenced to death for the Hodges murder. So in 1994, it would have been 95, 8 months later. So The authorities actually dug up the yard of Bramblett's former marital home. So the home where him and his wife had once lived.
Okay.
Searching for, yeah, the poet click. Searching for the evidence related to Tammy and Angela, possibly looking for bodies. They didn't find anything.
Ah.
The owner at the home at that time would not let them search inside the house, so they were not able to dig up the basement where a lot of people believe that the girls are buried. Oh. I think it was one of those basements either with a dirt floor or maybe concrete that he had poured after, like, once he was there. Angela Rader's mother passed away believing her daughter was alive.
Oh my gosh.
Tammy Aker's family believes that she is dead, and they believe that Earl Bramblett killed her and Angela in 1977. Unfortunately, Earl Bramblett took any secrets related to that case to his grave. Mm. And that is the story of Earl Bramblett and his tragic and delusional murder of the Hodges family. So what do you think?
Well,
sick puppy.
Super sick. And yeah. I think it's just obvious that he did it.
Yeah.
I don't care what he says. There's just too much evidence.
Yeah, and there are actually people online now that still think that he was falsely accused and convicted.
I just don't see how people can do that.
They think one of the things I saw was that video that they made of the truck to show that it would have been pinkish red in the light.
Yeah.
That they recorded that on the wrong part of the street. That the lights where the Hodges family home were not the same kind of lights that would have shown the truck to be pink. Like, that it was further down the street where they recorded. But the woman also said that he followed her for a little bit and then sped past her. So I'm like, well, it probably was in those lights anyway. When he was behind her, his headlights would probably have been on. So she wouldn't have seen the color of the truck at all.
Right, she wouldn't have been able to see
it. So if he followed her a little bit down the road and then sped past her, that's when she would have seen that it was a white male by himself in a pinkish-red truck, because he would have been under the lights.
Well, and back then, too, it's not like they have, like, we have these fancy bulbs that they put in our lights now on the streets once they burned out.
Yeah.
And they're really bright, like, LED type.
Right, yeah.
Well, they didn't have that then.
No,
so
they
everything
didn't.
Kind of had that pinkish-golden hue
yeah.
to it. In most
yeah,
places,
the lights were more yellow back then. I guess we're showing our age, but they were yellower back then than they are now. They're whiter now.
Especially in a little community.
Yeah, yeah, a little town like that. Yeah, absolutely. So they say that wasn't real. They say that the pubic hair, Earl Bramblett said that they discovered that after they'd already taken a sample of his. So he's basically suggesting that the police planted it. And I'm just like, you know what? They have 62 tapes with motive strewn throughout.
Absolutely.
You were lusting after a little girl, and you were accusing, in your delusional mind, accusing their father of putting an 11-year-old
tempting
in your face to tempt you into a trap. It's like, I don't care if they didn't find the pubic hair. They matched the firing pin to the gun, the shell casings. The bullets were made of the same materials, and bullets are basically, it's metals and composites or whatever in one big vat that makes a big vat of bullets.
Yeah.
So each vat is basically a little bit different. And I mean, they get thousands and thousands of bullets out of it, but for those to match the same material that were in the bullets of the...
Right.
And for it to be in the possession of their suspect, it makes sense.
Like, the statistics for that would be insane.
Exactly. It's like, I don't care if they made 10,000 bullets. They're still, you are friends with this family. You were there over the course of the weekend.
Yeah.
You were there around the time that Blaine was murdered, because he was murdered 12 to 24 hours prior. So, obviously, that connects. I don't care. That connects him. And despite all that other stuff, those tapes, to me, say it all. He was a sick man. He'd had a history of molesting little girls. He was constantly surrounded by children. And if you think about it, he and Blaine became friends when Blaine was in high school.
That's true. And he was a younger man then, too, himself. Yeah.
And so even though, like, maybe he wasn't interested in boys, but you know what comes around with boys? Teenage boys?
Little girls.
Teenage girls. Yes. Exactly. So... I'm like, I'm sorry, but he wrote his own death sentence, basically, I think, in those audio tapes.
I agree. And then the whole, like, with him clocking in, and then...
Yeah.
That just is...
Yeah.
It's too much of a coincidence.
Yeah. It's like, you left their house, and 20 minutes later, you clocked in at work.
And then marked it out? Like, why?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. And it was like... I read one place that it was early for him to be there, and I read another place that he was late. But either way, it was odd behavior
mm-hmm.
on that one morning. Whether he was early or late, it was different than the norm, and he marked it
and
out.
Then he
so
marked it
obviously
out.
Something, there was a guilty conscience for that.
Yeah. Guilty. You're guilty.
Guilty. We just decided. So, yep. All right. Well, so that is the Hodges family murder, and I really hope that one day Tammy and Angela's disappearance is solved for the sake of their families.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine what it would be like living all these years just not knowing. The not knowing would be harder than knowing that they had been killed or that they had just run off and they were living lives somewhere else. But not knowing has got to be the most terrifying thing.
Because then you live with hope that maybe they're still alive.
Right.
Like
her,
Angela's
like the mom.
Mother.
Yeah.
And bless her heart, I mean, I'm a mom. I would want to believe that forever until I knew different.
Right.
But it's just hard to think, especially now. Like,
yeah.
He's gone.
Well, and I would think that your brain would be constantly coming up with what ifs.
Oh my gosh.
And
exhaustion mentally.
Like, I think that the imagination would come up with worse things than what maybe even actually happened.
I agree.
So, because even if they'd run away, they could have gotten in, you know, they could have been sex trafficked. They could have gotten into drugs or prostitution or, you know, sex work or whatever. Or they could have run away and gotten husbands and had kids and lived a wonderful life, but they'll never know unless something comes of it.
I have
looked around trying to find the address of that freaking house. so I could find out, so we could be like, well, who owns it now, and keep
right.
an eye on it, you know, because I'm like, I want to dig up the basement.
I'd be really interested to see if there was anything
this,
there.
This story is interesting to me because we live in Virginia. Mm-hmm. The Hodges family, Winter Hodges, was the same age as our cousin, and they knew each other somehow. Mm-hmm. This was probably one of the first true crime stories that I really paid attention to.
Yeah.
Because in 1994, I was around 14 years old, so I didn't pay attention to the news. I didn't watch stuff like that. I was interested in all the other stuff that teenagers are interested in.
Right.
But I remember this because that the little 11-year-old girl that was killed was the same age as our cousin, and that they knew each other.
Right.
Yeah. And so part of me has always wondered when I, you know, when I got older and learned about the disappearances that Earl is suspected of, it made me wonder, like, one day maybe that house is up for sale, and if enough people can come together with GoFundMes and whatever now to purchase the house and dig up the basement.
Maybe like a petition or something.
Yeah. Like, I get the owners don't, you know, because I think, and if I'm wrong, somebody can tell me this, but I feel like if a police search damages the property, they don't pay to fix it.
I think you're right.
Like, especially if you give them permission to come in and dig up your basement. They're not going to pay. They'll dig it, and then they'll either make it a crime scene if they find something or not, and then they walk away and you're left with a dug-up basement. So,
yeah, it's part of the emergency services that are being provided, essentially, I think. I guess so, like that.
So I think that I get why the owners were like, no, you can't tear up the inside of my house, you know?
I mean, I get that, but
yeah, gosh. I know, but it's so hard. Like, I feel like if it was their kids, they'd have been like, do whatever you got to do.
Yeah.
But I'm not blaming them, but right. I get it to a point, but at the same time, I just feel for those families, so.
Well, and if there was something in the basement underneath, if I lived there, I wouldn't want to be sleeping upstairs knowing that there's
possibly bodies laying there or bones by now. Yeah, that would be creepy. Every time I went to the basement to do laundry or something, I'd be like, is there...
Am I standing on someone?
Yeah.
That sounds horrible, but that's what I would think.
Yeah, me too.
Oh my God, especially kids.
Yeah. Yeah, because they were 14. They were babies. I mean, they thought they were adults probably. We all did when we were 14. We're like, we know all the stuff. But they were kids.
Oh my gosh.
They were little kids.
What a horrible person.
I know.
Horrible.
He is a shit stain, and I'm kind of glad he's gone. So,
yeah,
you know, whether you agree with the death penalty or not, I'm just glad he's not around anymore.
I completely agree.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that was our first episode.
Woo-hoo!
So hopefully everything sounds good and we sound like complete professionals already, and everybody will tune in for the next one. But we're going to be doing this each week. Next week we'll have either another sad, depressing story like this one, or we might come up with something spooky or something inspiring. So stay tuned in and we'll catch you next time.
Bye, you guys. Bye.